Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnn.com and later permanently archived at alexlinder.com. You're welcome to join vnnforum.com and you can follow me at gab.com as well. We've done 10 chapters of Randolph O. Calverhall's Serpent's Walk, and today we're going to do chapters 11 and 12. They're a little bit shorter than the others, so probably will take a little less time. Let's get into it. Chapter 11 begins with an epigraph from Oswald Spengler, very short. Pacifism will remain an ideal if the white race decides to wage it no longer. There's a typo, so I'm not sure if he says the white race, but I'm pretty sure he does. Pacifism will remain an ideal if the white race decides to wage war, or I'm sorry, there's a chunk missing out of this. I think it is, if I can reconstruct from memory, pacifism will remain an ideal, war a reality. If the white race decides to wage it no longer, war that is, the dark ones will, and will win and become the masters of the world. Oswald Spengler, the great German philosopher. You may remember him from such quotations as Christianity is the godmother of Bolshevism. Chapter 11, Sunday, November 30th, 2042. It was a night of shadows, of women weeping, of whispers, of voices, of lips that mouthed meaningless words. Later, Lessing remembered lamplight, automobile headlights, the bare hissing blue-white bulbs of the factory, Jamila's worried questions, Wrench and the others arguing on and on, and Mrs. Mulder's brittle, near-hysterical giggle. Later he recalled dark-skinned men in loose, flapping, bone-hued clothing, hastening to and fro on what errands no one could say. It was indeed a night of shadows and of fear. Later he remembered mostly the fear. Sunday dawn, like any other day, cool and bright and smoke-fragrant, as was expected in India at this time of year. Indico's American and European staff teetered uneasily on Mrs. Mulder's spindly-legged dining room chairs on the mansion's spacious screen veranda. Before them, Inspector G.N. Subramaniam of the Indian CID paraded back and forth with the air of a man who has just seen an adversary fall flat on his face, but who doesn't dare to laugh. Not yet. Outside, squatting on the steps in the wintry sunshine, two squads of Indian Army Sipahis waited the command to take possession of the foreigner's property. "Still, we have no firm reports," Subramanian said was replying, or Subramaman was replying to Mrs. Satherley, the plump lady who ran Indico's accounts payable department. He spoke English with only a trace of the retroflexed consonants of his native Tamil, as different from the Hindi Urdu of northern India as Zulu is from Hungarian. The inspector was small, dapper, and very dark, like most South Indians. He said, "Everything is a shambles. We hear that much of Russia is devastated by this, whatever it is." Then a Soviet Politburo member came on the air from their defense headquarters in the Urals and accused you Americans of a sneak attack. Your people denied it, of course. Last night, some Russian madmen fired 7 missiles down from their satellites. They were promptly annihilated by particle beams from your ASAT space platforms. Preparations for war are in progress along the east-west frontiers in Europe. Today we have a news blackout. Chaos, madam, chaos. War in Europe? My God. Poor Mrs. Satherley mumbled dazedly. What about the United States? It is still all right. No attack upon your country yet, so far as New Delhi has deigned to inform us. But the world is stunned. Paralyzed. Russians, Poles, Czechs, most of the people of the Eastern Bloc are abandoning their homes and fleeing west, away from the plague. The situation is confused. Who can say what is happening? Subramanian took another turn around the polished concrete chip floor. Mrs. Mulder fluttered in the doorway to the drawing room. Behind her, Lessing glimpsed Jamila's turquoise Gamiz, or Kamiz. The CID officer noticed her too and raked her up and down with a single dark glance. He returned to stand in front of Herman Mulder. "Which brings me to you and your people," he said. "Our government has imposed an Emergency Powers Act as of 0600 hours this morning. In order not to become involved with what we perceive as a great powers confrontation, and for humanitarian reasons, we are repatriating all foreign nationals. This is for your own safety. You will be flown to Delhi and thence to whatever destination your embassies deem appropriate. There is a 48-hour deadline." He sounded as though he were reciting a catechism by rote. "The Russians in India?" Wrench inquired sweetly. "You're just going to drop them off at Moscow airport?" Subramanian bristled. "Nationals of other countries are not yet your affair. Your evacuation is an act of mercy. We are helping you rejoin your families and countrymen in this difficult time. The government of India is providing the aircraft and dispensing with such formalities as exit permits and income tax clearances. And handing out tea and stale cookies in the Delhi Airport departure lounge," Wrench grumbled. If the inspector heard him, he ignored him. He faced Mulder. "Arrangements have been made for custody of foreign property." He indicated the waiting soldiers outside. "Indico will remain in good hands until matters become clear." Which, Lessing suspected, probably meant never. This was Prime Minister Ramanujan's chance to rid India of alien corruption and acquire heaps of foreign loot, cancel repayments of foreign loans, and do away with unwelcome foreign trade treaties, all for very understandable reasons. Let the Pardesis argue and complain and file claims and hold hearings and whine to the United Nations or the World Court if those august bodies still existed. The lacily intricate convolutions of Indian bureaucracy would keep things tied up for years, and even then foreign investors would likely receive only partial compensation. The grandchildren of the people in this room might not live to see Indico return to its original owners. So much for Mulder's belief that third world countries were safer for his SS corporations than the West. "What of us?" Mrs. Nellacroix asked from the far end of the veranda. "Two of my companions and I hold South African passports." Subramanian shrugged. "India has no relations with South Africa. You will have to return on commercial aircraft when and if available. Our own plane and pilot are waiting for us in Delhi. Then we shall fly you there. After that, it is the government's decision." The inspector gestured to show the assembly was dismissed. "He ought to wear jodhpurs and carry a riding crop," Wrench whispered to Lessing. "Bureaucrats, the true enemies of the human race." Chairs squealed on the cement floor. People collided, jabbered, and rushed off to pack. Mulder plodded grimly into the house, Mrs. Mulder flittering behind, trilling at him about her precious furniture and knickknacks. The fairy godmother had long since discovered that chinaware and brass statues made acceptable substitutes for non-existent children. Lessing had little worth taking, a single valise and his gun case. The one other thing he dared not leave behind was hidden in the factory, his cache of Pakov. But how could he reach it with Subramanian's officious doggies guarding the gates? He couldn't just abandon the stuff. Some blundering maintenance man would find it, and then there would be deaths indeed, deaths like those in Russia, deaths that put earthquakes and volcanoes and the Black Plague and even Hiroshima to shame. He had to assume that it was Pakov that now stalked the world, and he himself had helped to raise it from its tomb and give it life. Alan Lessing, Dr. Frankenstein. No, damn it, he refused to accept the guilt. Why should he? He was not responsible. It was not Alan Lessing who had ordered the canisters scattered across Russia. He had not released invisible murder upon the world. He was only the delivery boy, just weapons transport, like the crew of the Enola Gay, the plane that dropped the first atomic bomb. Hell, he was less than that. He was the postman who unknowingly delivers a parcel with a bomb inside. So he told himself. Wait a minute. Just what did he think he was doing at Marvelous Gap in the first place? His employers hadn't sent his team there to steal a new technological gigaw or some piddling trade secret. A spec shop like Marvelous Gap wasn't mounted for peanuts. He should have guessed, of course, but he hadn't let himself think about it. The comparison with the Enola Gay was accurate. Therefore, but the innocent postman excuse clunked like a lead $5 piece. But was he responsible? He had no idea his objective was so monstrously lethal, and he would never have believed anybody would be insane enough to use it. As Wrench said, they hadn't bought that one at Nuremberg either. There had not been time to assimilate the enormity of what had happened. Now it was beginning to hit home. He felt shaken, sick, empty in the pit of his stomach, like a kid who sets a school wastebasket on fire for a joke and then watches the building burn to the ground with his friends inside. Whoever had unleashed Pakov, the world was now altered forever. Nothing would ever be the same again. The flat was empty when he entered, as impersonal as a hotel room between guests. A few hours ago it had been a home of sorts, now it was a stopover, a bus station lobby. He would have sworn that the place even smelled different. He collected his kit from the white-tiled bathroom, then emerged to stand aimlessly in the middle of the sitting room. The fireplace was dank and charred. It reminded him of Syria, of a house shattered by artillery fire, of a broken doll and a smashed chair. For want of anything else to do, he picked up his Aladdin's lamp. There was room in the suitcase, and he stuffed it inside. Jamila's clothes were gone, her closet door ajar. Desolation washed over him. It would be like her to vanish quietly without a scene, without a long goodbye. He fingered the nubbly tan fabric of the sofa. Just last night she was there. He knew it even before her jasmine scent reached his nostrils. He turned to find her in the doorway. So? She had a knack of summing up a whole lifetime in a single word. So I go. He sucked in the empty house smell. You coming? How can I? The Americans won't take me. They would if you were my wife. We could say you were, that we didn't have time to collect our documents. Mulder and Wrench will back us up. She was silent. Then she said, No, I can't leave my family. Damn your family, he exploded. Talk about us. She hesitated again. No, Alan, you don't understand. We are not so individual as you. To us, a marriage is more than a bride and groom, a husband and a wife. The families must be involved, social obligations met, people satisfied. He snarled an obscenity. Fuck. Please, try to see. She put her fingers to his cheek. Maybe later, when things are calm again. His fists were clenched so tightly they hurt. Don't you see? Things will never be calm again. After I leave, we may never even meet again. Mulder's talking about going back to South Africa with Mrs. Delacroix and Lisa. Yes, Lisa, the American woman with the South African passport. This was no time for jealousy. Yes, her. Back to South Africa, or maybe to that resort, what's its name, the Nponape in the South Pacific. Not to the United States? No, Mulder says that would be pointless. He has nothing in the States. He says we can't do any good there, not now, not under the circumstances. He still wants me as his bodyguard. Most of Indico's cartel is out here in what you call the Third World. My father says that Herman Mulder is a powerful man in many countries. Your father is right. This was the first time she had mentioned her father in this context. What's Mulder got to do with us? He is your boss? Jamila stood nose to nose with him, her long-lashed eyes watching him levelly. He is the owner of the SS subsidiaries, or SS diaries, is he not? You know about that? We know. She stressed the pronoun slightly. We know. My father knows. A few others high up in our CID, not Subramanian. He's a small fish. The diaries again. It was too late to worry about such irrelevant things now. The whole world was upside down, and Mulder's secrets were less important than tomorrow's breakfast, than gasoline for Mrs. Delacroix's airplane, than the guns Lessing had just packed away. He couldn't resist a question. The two men who broke into Mulder's safe, ours, Arabs, I think, not very good thieves. They weren't supposed to hurt anyone, and you weren't supposed to hurt them. They were ordered to bring the diaries out to be photographed, to give the government of India leverage against Indico. Then they were to put them back. That business with your friend Bauer put you too much on the alert. Your people knifed him? No, we still don't know what that was about. She flung a brooding look. It had to do with you, though, didn't it, Alan? He scowled. Yes, possibly. Hell, I don't know. But not with Mulder's diaries. It was her turn to frown. I didn't want to become involved with you, Ellen. That wasn't in the plan. I do want to go with you. You don't know how much. Then come. Your job's over. Mulder's leaving. There's nothing more to report. We get married. Later we make to your fatherland, your mother, and the rest of your family, all of India, damn it, understand. Her features softened. All of India? It will be hard convincing all of India that we, my father, my family, my Shi'i co-religionists, the Sunni Muslims, should even continue to live. My people came from Iran and the Middle East as conquerors, but we stayed to work, to serve, to partake. We became Indians. We are Indians. We were outsiders, like the Greeks and Aryans before us, but now we are Indians. She saw his puzzlement. Why do I talk of this now? Because of Subramaniam and his ilk, zealots like those who attacked you in the bazaar yesterday. To them, we Muslims are as alien as you are. We are polluted and unclean. Sooner or later, we must fight a civil war. The army? Previously neutral, the older generals were intelligent enough to realize that tearing India to pieces and killing or expelling 150 million people would destroy us all. But now Prime Minister Ramanujan has stacked the high command with his own people. The army obeys the order of the BSS. Lessing asked, what will you, your people, do? We have nowhere to go. Iran was Shi'i, or Shia. Now the western half is Israeli and the eastern half Russia. If the Russians are still alive to hold it. Afghanistan has been theirs for almost half a century, ever since the reinvasion. The Middle East? Israel would never let us in. Pakistan, a Sunni majority and a rabidly pro-communist Mullahs leader, Sajid Ali Lahori would prefer us to starve in refugee camps in the deserts of Kutch and eastern Punjab. Like I said, what will you do? She shrugged gracefully and his heart went out to her. Do we will live on here. If Ramanujan tries to expel us, we will fight. We will lose, of course, but we will fight. So will the Sikhs and some of the Christians. We will die, as Muslims should. Martyrs. Borchardt's characterization of Shi'i Islam arose to infuriate him. What the hell good is that? God damn it, you are coming with me. Get your clothes. Get what you want to take. She melted against him, and he thought he had won. Then she pulled away. You still don't, never will, understand. I cannot. I must not. She retreated toward the door. I have my principles, Alan, just as you have yours. Your party, your SS oaths. Wait a minute, I'm only a BG, hired help. I'm not one of Mulder's closet Nazis. It was logical for her to think so. Her father's CID Kiki Birds had undoubtedly classified them all as Nazis, from Mulder on down to the kids who wiped the dishes. It doesn't matter. That's not the point. Not now. She pressed her fingers against her cheeks to hide tears, lest her night-black tresses drift down to curtain her face, or let her night-black tresses drift down to curtain her face, and backed into the hall. Whatever you are not mine, not for me, not a part of India. He followed her, reached for her. Then he saw that there was someone in the hall behind her, one of the faceless, rag-wrapped sweeper women who wielded short-handled straw brooms around Indigo's buildings. He opened his mouth to tell the woman to go elsewhere, but Jamila spoke first. Sahib Kodido, vochis jo turni paiti dedu? She was ordering the crone to give him something. That much he understood. The woman approached him shyly, crabwise, head bowed, face hidden by her faded green shawl. She extended skeletal hands. Wondering, he cupped his own beneath hers. Two objects dropped into his palms. He knew at once what they were. One a smooth egg, the other a short, thick cylinder. My God! He almost dropped them. My present, Jamila said, to you, Alan, in memory of us. They're yours, aren't they? Drugs, weapons, now, don't tell me, I don't want to know. He couldn't speak, he was only glad that she seemed to have no idea what these containers held. Hamida here saw you hide them. It's impossible to remain unseen in India. We are so many. Peasants, laborers, children, people with no jobs and little to do. Everybody watches. A rupee buys a day's food. It's cheap to hire watchers. or anything else you want. Thank her for me. He stowed the pack-off containers into his shaving kit. Why didn't you tell your father, Subramanian? I would report on Mulder, on Wrench, certainly on Goddard, but never on you, Alan. As for Subramanian, he hates you, all foreigners, but he hates us Muslims, too, and the Christians, and the Sikhs, and everybody else who isn't a caste Hindu. I told him only what I thought was my duty. As for Hamida, she is a Christian, the lowest of the low, the outcast who joined Christianity during British rule to escape persecution. She would rather die than tell the mighty Inspector Sahib a single thing. He went to her, and this time she did not pull away. Hamid watched impassively as they kissed. When this is over, Jamila murmured. It would never be over. The world had turned. A new day had dawned, a judgment day of wrath and chaos and terror. It would never be over. But he smiled anyway and held her close, letting her warm, dry, spice-fragrant body nestle against his own. He rumpled her hair in his fist, strained against her, and let her feel his yearning. Soon, he whispered, I'll be back for you. He hoped he wasn't too bad a prophet. And that's the end of chapter 11. Chapter 12 begins with an epigraph from H.L. Mencken. For every complex question, there is a simple answer, and it's wrong. Chapter 12, Thursday, December 11th, 2042. Jennifer Caw tapped her sunglasses against the metal rim of the glass-top beach table. It was the Jews, I say. The Israelis, backed by their puppets in the United States. Doubtful, Hans Borchardt countered. They'd kill their relatives who still live in Russia. Madness, not even the most hawkish Jews would do that. They might think a few hundred thousand lives were a fair exchange for knocking off their most dangerous enemy. Or they may have the antidote, vaccine, whatever, for Pakov. Smuggle that into Russia first, and the Jews there form a ready-made occupying force. A handful of mostly untrained women and kids, many older and firm. Be serious, Jennifer. Then, too, the Israelis may have had information we don't. Maybe they saw a first strike as the only way out of a nasty situation. Remember the troop movements north of Iran a few months ago. There were Arabs or Pakistanis or Afghans caught inside Russian-controlled territory about the same time, weren't there? Plenty of stateless assassins the Israelis could hire. The big powers would never allow the balance to be upset. Neither an Israeli attack on Russia nor a Russian thrust to halt the Israelis' push through Iran as long as they stopped at the Afghan border. The Americans and the Russians had this all worked out. Precisely why the Israelis might have used Pakov as a means to break the deadlock and get on with their expansion. A surgical first strike. Tell nobody and get the job done. Too risky. They gain little. Crap. Jennifer popped her tongue against her teeth, one of her least ladylike habits. Look at Eastern Europe now. Empty, rich, and chock full of loot all the way from the German border over to Siberia. Practically no defenses. Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Poland, a jumble of desperate refugees and practically no local authorities left. Germany struggling to keep the refugees from crossing her own borders. Turkey, Greece, and the Balkans, harmless. Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan in turmoil. China already gobbling up Mongolia and the East. Are you telling me that Israel doesn't gain by this? She can grab giant hunks of Russian and Ukrainian territory before anybody else gets to them. Lebensraum, Hans, Eretz Israel, kosher delicatessens in Kharkov and Donetsk. Borchardt fussed with his white Club Lingani t-shirt. His first acquisition on Ponape had been a monumental tropical sunburn. He pursed his lips and said, "The Americans will not let Israel do that. Already they're helping the survivors. Some of their team have reached Moscow, decon squads, doctors, epidemiologists, not occupation troops. They'll find excuses to stay. So will the British in Leningrad, the Germans in Kiev, and the Chinese in Vladivostok. First, they become permanent missions, then colonists. After a while, they own the place, like the Israelis on the West Bank 80 years ago." The sunglasses ticked out a distracting rhythm against the tabletop. Jennifer Kaw played to win, even in a friendly debate. No, the Israelis came, they saw, they conquered, and they stayed. Mulder picked up a radio newscast yesterday that said three Israeli armored columns are already moving north from Tabriz through to Tbilisi. Are they just going straight up to Moscow, or sending a spearhead northwest to Kharkov and Kiev, or just grabbing everything they can reach? No question it's the Jews, Wrench proclaimed from beneath his sun hat. Lessing had thought him asleep. Who profits from exterminating Russia? The West, right? And who runs the West? Lessing stayed motionless. The others mostly let him alone, but Wrench delighted in a little missionary work now and then. Jennifer asked carefully, "You fought for the Israelis in Syria, didn't you, Alan? You must know them well." "I was only a hired hand, a merc. No policy decisions." He felt her eyes prying at the top of his skull. He refused to be dragged into these discussions. Give him something to do, and he'd do it. Debate was not his forte. After a moment, Jennifer went on, "It's not fair to blame only the Jews, even if they do turn out to be responsible for Pakov. Others in the system profit as well. The great corporations, the banks, the big international combines, all those who gain from an American Jewish hegemony over a half-empty world." "Half-empty?" Wrench chuckled. "Like the old joke, the pessimist sees the glass as half-empty, the optimist as half-full. The Jews will drink the contents and keep the glass too, and make sure the world loves them for doing it. The chosen people value their lovable image. Oh yeah, they'll be kind to any surviving immunes, the women and the kids. You'll see, they'll turn it into the greatest dramatic miniseries ever seen on TV. One that makes you feel all warm and gushy inside." "We may be wrong," Borchert mused. "The Palestinians could have done this, or the Latin Americans, the Ethiopians, Afghans, or Salvadorans. God knows there are enough dispossessed and bitter people out there. Even the British or the French or some smaller nation." "Or loonies right out of the funny papers," Wrench scolded. Borchert fingered the nape of his neck gingerly. It was bright red. "Did you hear about someone blaming the neo-Nazis? If they knew about it, us, we'd top the list." "We'd have to be crazy," Jennifer exploded. "All the money we've spent to legitimize our political movement. Years of planning wasted. What do we want with a plague-ridden world or an atomic cinder?" "Nazis make the best villains," Wrench snickered. "When in doubt, punch out the least popular kid in the block. I'm sure they can work out an evil Nazi super scientist into their miniseries. A gang of black-uniformed SS troopers. A couple of death camps." Lessing grew bored listening. These people speculated and wrangled endlessly, the way monkeys picked fleas. They had been at it since leaving India a week ago, an aimless meandering safari that had taken them first to South Africa, where Mrs. Delacroix's friends warned her against remaining, not only out of fear of Pakov, but because trouble was brewing with the blacks again. Mulder had urged them to join him on Pone, as remote and safe as a spot could be, found in an increasingly unstable world. They had all accepted. Mrs. Delacroix appeared pale and disoriented, and Lisa stayed close by her side. Jennifer Kaw was used to traveling around the world with no more detailed plan than tomorrow's plane ticket. She was wealthy, Lessing learned, the offspring of two wealthy South American descendant families. Her father had built up a computer empire in the United States. Borchert tagged along, due more to an infatuation with Jennifer Kaw than out of fear of Pakov. His business involved liaisons between European and Third World corporations, and he spent much time on Poneyp's primitive satellite telecom hookup. Borchert was also a descendant. His ancestors had not fled Germany after the Second World War, however. They had hoped to live quietly until memories had faded, but they had reckoned without the tenacity of the Nazi hunters and the media. Hans never discussed what had happened to them. Communist, liberals, centrists, nearly everybody had political freedom in Germany, but not the far right, the offspring of those who had once proudly borne Germany's banners. They were still anathema. Lessing sat up and shaded his eyes, squinting against the shimmering sand for a glimpse of Mrs. Delacroix and Lisa. They had wandered off the beach that had fronted Club Lingany's property on Maldoinu Bay. Mulder's corporate octopus had spent a bundle getting that beach sanded and landscaped. Poneyp was a Micronesian, quote, high, volcanic island, and not the idyllic Polynesian coral atoll of the South Pacific romances. It rained here almost every day, and the low shoreline was covered with scraggly mangrove forest and tangled undergrowth. Personally, Lessing thought that Mulder and his SS comrades had been slickered when they bought Club Lingani. Tonga, Tahiti, or Samoa, this was not. He heard a faint chanting. Not wily natives, but teenagers from the club. Presently there were about 900 guests, mostly young people from many countries and organizations. Felix Bauer, attired in shorts and an alpine hat with a red feather in it, was visible in the distance on the beachfront road, pacing a column of khaki-clad youths doing military drill. Back off the beach, among the ever-present breadfruit trees, stood new dormitories and flats, administrative buildings, a recreation hall, classrooms, a radio tower, a private landing strip, swimming pools, a sports arena, and a full-scale hospital. Certain less public facilities were concealed by the vegetation as well. An obstacle course, target ranges, an armory containing a surprising variety of modern weapons, and bunkers that served both as defenses and as practice military objectives. The island's government in the town of Colonia to the north, with a K, smiled benignly and reaped the fruits of tourism. Lessing sat back down again. He had nothing to do this afternoon. His own pupils, those learning guerrilla tactics and weapons, were on an archaeological field trip, building muscles, helping the local historical society excavate the ruins of Nan Madol. That was a fascinating place. Behind a 2 kilometer long breakwater stood a deserted city of stone platforms, with canals and channels between them big enough for canoes at high tide, a junior-sized Venice. The walls of these platforms were constructed of huge blocks and columns of prismatic basalt with cores of sand and stones and rubble. Some of the platforms contained tombs, the remains of the Sao de Lure dynasty that had gone extinct not long before the first Europeans arrived. Others served as foundations for temples, ceremonial sites, and priestly dwellings. Lessing had once picnicked with Lisa within the brooding, enigmatic sepulchre of Nan Duas, the mightiest of all Nan Madal's structures. They had sensed something of the remote grandeur of the ancient past and left early, well before sunset, by unspoken mutual consent. These days, Lessing was having enough trouble sleeping as it was. Sometimes he dreamed of a bizarre corporation meeting in which he himself was honored as Salesman of the Month. It was never explicitly stated, but he knew what the company's sole product was. Death, packaged in pretty little perfume bottles. In other dreams, he walked amidst the tombs of Nan Madol, and the spirits of the vanished chiefs chanted and shook their plumed and feathered heads at him. Were there ghosts? Did the specters of the Russian dead communicate with them, the spirits of old Ponape? He had little religious training and even less belief. All he knew was that he was going out of his mind. The current president of Ponape, the paramount chief, the Nanmwarki, to give him his archaic title, revived after independence and reinterpreted to fit the current American democracy political model, was fascinated by ancestral glories, real or imagined, hence the archaeology at Nan Madol. The agonies of a dying Europe were far away, irrelevant to Ponape and the empty sweep of the Pacific. Given time, Ponape might become a nation-state, a fledgling empire which would war with the distant islands of Truk or Khuzray. The drums would thunder as they had in centuries gone, and the war canoes would venture forth to repeat the world's sad story one more time here in the Micronesian microcosm. Lisa appeared far down the beach. She came up to them, breathless, dark blonde hair, skin of golden bronze, and otter sleek. Lessing admired her. There had been no need to explain about Jamila. Lisa understood. Since arriving on Ponape, she and Lessing had been friends. Just that, and no more. The fire was banked, the coals buried. They both realized that it would take very little to make it blaze up again. "Mrs. Delacroix," she said, "back to the house." With the others, Lisa still spoke in choppy phrases. She was more relaxed when she and Lessing were alone. Any news? Jennifer appraised her covertly, the look of the not-so-pretty second banana eyeing the belle of the beach. Lessing was amused. People were the same everywhere. Radio says situation soon under control in most areas. Refugees from Russia are being rounded up, repatriated soon as the plague's gone. Well, hallelujah for that, Jennifer said. I'd hate to see Prague or Budapest or Vienna go the way of Moscow. Some refugees broke through into Germany, though, rioting and killing still going on. Jesus, Wrench breathed. Lessing echoed him and Borchardt. Borchardt hissed something in German. Mess, Lisa added, unnecessarily everywhere. At least nobody's using nukes, Wrench growled. No, major powers trying to cool things. Enough dead now. The understatement of all time. Lessing saw ghosts again. The beach swarmed with Russians, Germans, Poles, Czechs, Hungarians, American soldiers in torn and bloody green uniforms. He wanted to cry out, but could not. The spectral figures swirled, accused, and disappeared. All but one, which kept coming toward him, a pale, pink old man, nude except for white shorts and thong sandals, a necklace, bald, ugly Cupid doll. It was Herman Mulder, stepping gingerly down to the hot sand from the path that led to club headquarters. Wrench got to his feet to hand their employer a beach towel. Sir? Mulder waved it away, although his forehead was bedewed with bright droplets. News. Terrible. Goddard's on the radio now. Russian somebody hit the United States. Biological weapon. They all babbled at once. Struck Washington, New York, Chicago. Used the water supplies as the vector. A bacteria-generated toxin, something like botulin, as deadly as botulin anyway. But the microorganism which released it is aerobic and thrives in places, including the human body, where Clostridium botulinum can't. And it's highly contagious. God, so many dead. My mother, Jennifer screamed, in Los Angeles. Telephone. You'll never get through, Mulder outshouted her. I tried. We're not sure what's happened. Los Angeles may be all right. Be patient, for God's sake. Calm down. Nothing but military emergency broadcast now, anyway. Jennifer continued to wail. Help her, please, Lisa. Goddard's talking to some shortwave ham in Ottawa. Toronto's been struck, too, he says. I've got to call my mother. Jennifer dug scarlet fingernails into ashen cheeks and dashed away up the path toward the radio tower. Borchardt followed her. Lessing discovered Lisa in his arms. She had no recollection of putting her there, or he had no recollection of putting her there. She pressed against him and husked. You? Anybody in States? Nobody I really knew anymore. You? She shook her golden mane. Same. Now? God knows. Stay here? Wait it out? Become citizens of the sovereign state of Poneape? Gone. She began to shudder, then to cry. Gone. All finished. He wasn't sure what she meant. Their enterprise here? The party of humankind? Western civilization? The whole human race? Did little details matter? Mulder was saying, properly delivered, 8 ounces of botulin toxin could wipe out most advanced life on Earth. Creating a new bacterium to do that job was the trick. This must be the Russians' Sterak, their answer to Pakov, their revenge. Revenge, Wrench groaned. Surely not just revenge. They'd have to be crazy. The old system bred insanity. Isn't that what our movement is about? To unify, to establish order, to build a united world in which this could never happen? Lessing said, revenge maybe, more likely just determination. You lose a battle, but you don't give up the war. The enemy deals you a blow, you slug him back harder. What the hell for, Wrench cried, to own a dead and destroyed planet? Shit. What's destroyed? It's all still here. Lots of people gone, but so what? Piles of plunder, economic goodies. Lebensraum, buddy. Like you guys always say, we win, we get it all. You win, you do. God damn it, doesn't that make sense? Soldiers, Lisa whispered sadly. She sounded more mournful than accusing. She drew back out of Lessing's arm to stare up into his face. Alan's right, Mulder told her. That's what any committed patriot would do. Fight to the last. Defeat your enemy at any cost. Then hope you have enough left to rebuild. Anywhere else hit? Wrench inquired. There's a lot going on. Goddard heard that the British blew up a fishing boat in the channel while it was laying down some sort of fog from aerosol tanks. They got the boat, but the wind still carried the stuff over the English coast. No reported deaths yet. The Chinese caught somebody too, a Latin American of some kind. He had an empty bottle. What was in it? Lessing asked. Vino, Wrench couldn't help snickering. Mulder gave him a pained look. They haven't any idea. The mob got to him first and tore him to bits. Goddard picked this up just before the news about Washington came in. In vino veritas, in wine truth. Now it's in vino botulinus, in wine botulin. Wrench's small, handsome features resembled an embalmer's masterpiece more than any living thing. He hunkered down upon his beach towel and stared out to sea. Mulder beckoned Lessing aside. We're going back, he announced. What? Where? To the United States. Guam, Hawaii, then McCord Air Force Base in Washington State, from there to the Cheyenne Mountain Complex in Colorado. That's insane, Lessing cried. What about the toxin? I've been told that as long as one avoids contact with infected corpses and doesn't drink unsterilized water, it should be reasonably safe. Anyhow, we pick up decon suits and a special escort plane in Hawaii. May I ask why? He was treading on dubious ground. An employee, especially in a mercenary BG, didn't ask questions of the boss. Mulder said, ever heard of Jonas Outram, the Speaker of the House of Representatives? Yes, of course. Well, he's president pro tem now. Old Rubin and his cabinet drank water with their breakfast in Washington, D.C. The vice president had a shower and a morning gargle in New York. Now they're all dead. By American law, the presidency passes to the Speaker of the House. My God. Wrench looked up and said, one thing the establishment never figured on. They threw Outram that post like you'd toss a bone to a barking dog. A little present to the opposition to make things look democratic. Now I'll bet they're sorry. He began to laugh, shakily, except they're thumbed. Most of the government in Washington is gone, Mulder said. Who knows how many thousands, maybe millions. But Cheyenne Mountain has its own internal water supply, and the country's defense command is safe. The Army's declared martial law and called up all the National Guard units they can still reach. They're trying to put it back together. And you're going to see Outram, sir. He wants to see me. The movement, rather. All of the so-called right-wing parties. Get ready. We leave tonight. Mulder turned and strode across the beach toward the red roofs of the administrative buildings. From behind the screen of glossy green breadfruit trees, Lessing could still hear Bauer's sharp marching cadence and the strains of Lily Marlena, sung off-key by a bunch of kids whose German was elementary. The music still had a certain fateful ring to it. And that's the end of Chapter 12 in our recording session today. Thanks for being with me again. My name is Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. which you're welcome to join, or you can simply read and hit links from the outside. But thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again with more from Serpent's Walk real soon.